Okay, can you tell me exactly what happened?
What's the name of this condo? Maple's Keep Commons is the name of the apartment.
Okay, not the Palm River?
Yeah, no, that's the estate where it's in. It's off of Markley Road. That's this way east, that's the name of the street.
Okay, does that person you're with know the address?
It's apartment number.
Apartment. You're at apartment number?
Yes.
Okay, can you ask the person you're with what the address is?
He doesn't know the address, he just knows some numbers.
Okay, and it's Naples, what is it called? Ma'am, you said it's Naples?
Keep.
Okay.
Yeah, Keep. K-E-E-P. Naples Keep. Yeah.
Okay, and tell me exactly what happened there.
I don't know. I'm outside.
Okay, well, what made you call 911?
The one that lives here. He's standing at the door and he doesn't want to let me in the apartment. The one that's in there with him.
Okay, and what's wrong? Why did you call 911?
He looks like he's been beat up or he's bleeding. I don't know whether he's hurt himself or what.
Okay, and you don't have any information on what happened to him?
No, he just called me. I live on a... And he just called me, and I came over here.
Okay, how old is he?
He's 36.
Okay, is he awake?
Yes, he's standing by the door.
Is he violent?
No.
Okay, you said he's not letting you in.
He's asking me all these questions.
You need somebody who needs to call 911.
It is.
Okay, but I need to understand what is going on there. You're not being very clear with me about what's happening on scene so I can tell the people that are responding.
He's bleeding, that's all I know.
Okay, we don't know why he's bleeding?
What is it?
There's blood. I don't know. He lives here alone, so I don't know. He just called
me. Okay, your husband was inside. Ask him to tell me what happened.
I don't know what happened, ma'am. He won't let us in. There's blood all over here. Somebody over here now.
Okay, sir, I need to explain something to you. When you dialed 911, you've gotten Lee County, and you're inside of call to gather as much information as possible to pass it on to the appropriate responders. Okay, I need you to tell me, what did he say to you?
He won't let me in, but there's blood all over the floor and everything.
Okay, is he bleeding or is somebody else inside the apartment bleeding?
I don't know. He's not saying. You don't want him. He probably so. I don't know.
Okay, do you know if there's anyone else inside of his apartment?
He probably does. He won't let me in. I got the door open, but he won't let us go in.
Is he violent, sir?
No, he's not violent.
Okay, and why did he say why he won't let you in?
What's that?
Can he tell you why he won't let you in?
No, he's probably got somebody in there. He says he don't know what happened.
Okay, sir. Sheriff's Office, do you have further questions for this caller?
This is Lee County, ma'am.
Okay, do you have any law enforcement questions for this caller?
No, ma'am, not at this time.
Okay, sir, I'll stay on the line with you as long as I can. If you get any further information about what's happening inside, please let me know so I can update Collier County.
Well, you need to send somebody over, please. I think there's somebody in there.
You think that there's somebody in there?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know who might be in there with them?
Please.
Hello.
I am Lauren.
I am Ken.
And this is Paradise After Dark.
Dark.
Paradise After Dark is a podcast covering true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
missing people,
urban legends, and the dark side of the Sunshine State.
If you would like to support our show and get a bunch of extra Paradise After Dark content, sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/Paradise After Dark Podcast.
And be sure to go and check out our website.
Yes, ParadiseAfterDark.com is our website, and there you can find links to all of our episodes, our mailing list, our merch store, our social medias, and, of course, links to our Patreon.
Paradise After Dark swag. We got our old logo, our original logo, old logo, and the new stuff. We're just loaded up on there. We got all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, we got a ton of stuff. Just go check it out.
Go check out our website. Tell us what you think.
Check it out. All right. So we are diving right back into part two of the Paradise After Dark special, A Tangled Web of Murder.
Well, let's think of a quick recap that we can kind of bring this all together.
Well, first of all, I just want to say, if you haven't listened to part one, press pause, go back, listen to part one, and then come back and finish here.
Yeah, because otherwise you're
not going to know what we're talking about if you don't go listen to part one. But to give you a crip.
What? A crip and a blood.
To give you a quick recap. So, a woman named Christine Moritz was murdered by her estranged husband at Physicians Regional Hospital in Naples, Florida, in room 303 as she was visiting a friend and coworker who was actually in the hospital.
Yeah, Moritz showed up and went into the room and shot her and
shot his wife and then shot himself. But, oops. He couldn't even commit suicide correctly because he lived. He went to trial. He was convicted of second-degree murder and is spending his life in prison. But we find out that Christine Moritz was having an affair with a man named Christopher Serna. Now, 3 weeks to the day after Christine Moritz is murdered, Christopher Serna is found in his apartment by his parents, covered in blood.
And in the beginning, the 911 call, those are his parents struggling to try to get help.
Because they have come to his apartment and discovered him covered in blood, but he won't allow them inside the apartment. But later we learn that a woman named Suzanne Bishop was actually inside the apartment and she had been brutally, brutally murdered.
You want to go ahead and start there, and let's break out what the details of how this all come together here?
Yep.
Okay, so on the morning of July 26, 2011, as mentioned earlier, after his parents found him covered in blood and called 911, police entered Serna's apartment, and there was blood everywhere. Now, when the police entered, they said they found Suzanne's head in the living room and her body in the bedroom of the apartment, and blood completely covered the walls. So you just picture this scene, that's kind of a graphic scene, but this is what the police are faced with when they walk in. And it would soon be discovered that Serna had stabbed Suzanne Bishop over 100 times. He had cut off her head and put it on a metal rod. So he
put her head on a stake as like to display it.
Exactly. And he also cut off her nipples and attached them to the door frame using thumbtacks. And it took investigators 3 days to process this gruesome crime scene. They had bloody items were found all over the home, including several knives. There was a Louisville Slugger baseball bat. There were beer bottles, cigarettes, clothes. I mean, there's everything in this house. There's blood everywhere. And the cutting off the nipples, didn't we cover a case that recently just talked about that?
Cutting off, I don't know, maybe. I try and forget those kinds of things when we cover them.
Yeah, I don't blame you there. That's just absolutely crazy.
But what they found was definitely something that was out of this world, bizarre. The stuff of movies, like A House of a Thousand Corpses.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, I'm feeling for these officers and investigators that had to go in there and see this with their own eyes.
That's a good point. Sometimes people forget that.
So even more disturbing was the gruesome journals written by Christopher Serna, police recovered from while they were investigating the crime. So the journals contained writings penned over dozens of pages, often in lyrical form, describing grotesque fantasies of death, murder, and necrophilia. They were often written in first person, enumerating the exact ways in which the author planned to kill, according to court records. Now, here is one example of a little poem that this sicko wrote. "See, my problems is pain. I'm infatuated with it. Not to bring it on myself, but onto others. I'd love to take someone's life. I think about it every day, and sometimes I actually take the time to plan it out." Now, that's just an excerpt from his journal. Now, later on the same day that Suzanne Bishop's body was found, Cerna sat throughout his interrogation while still covered in blood, mumbling and twitching, his head and eyes occasionally darting from side to side. He said little about Suzanne Bishop and seemed unaware that she was even dead.
Wow.
Cerna repeatedly referenced God and writing and a woman named Christine.
Who
she
I think
was
we
later
know.
Determined to be Christine Moritz,
yep.
Who, as we all know by now, was having an affair with Cerna before she was murdered by her estranged husband 3 weeks earlier. Cerna repeatedly talked about Christine. On multiple occasions, Cerna said, "Her husband shot her because of me, and that Christine told me she needed to be okay." Now, inside Cerna's condo, investigators found email and obituary printouts related to Moritz's death. For the first hour of his interview, Cerna stuttered and whispered, never raising his voice. He finally became more vocal when asked why he didn't want anybody to go in his condo to find Bishop's body. "Because God told me to," Cerna shouted. But from there, Cerna never explained what happened inside the residence. Detectives implored him to describe what happened, asking what they would tell his two children. In a monotone voice, Cerna replied, "Tell them God says that we love them." When asked about the homicide, Cerna repeatedly said, "I remember I was writing." Now, a few pages in his journal included exact details of the crime scene, suggesting Cerna either meditated on the homicide or wrote about it afterward. Throughout the 75-minute interview, Cerna had no apparent recollection of the murder. Detectives described his demeanor as an act or a charade on a couple of occasions during the interrogation, but Cerna remained visibly unstable the entire time.
Well, yeah,
this is like so weird. So I don't even know like how to take this.
Yeah, this is like Lauren mentioned earlier. It's very movie-esque because not only do the police walk in and they find this horrific scene. Now they take the suspect, if you will, to interrogation. They're interrogating him, and he's sitting there covered in the blood, everything that resembles the sight that they just endured. And they're asking questions, and he's acting the part of this whack job, this crazy person, you know. And I don't want to get into details just yet. So let's talk about this for a minute. Let's talk about who Christopher Cerna is and possibly what made him do this. So by most accounts, Cerna's life was remarkably ordinary up until the killing, making the barbaric homicide all the more puzzling. Now, Cerna had no known history of violence. His only arrest involved having recreational amounts of marijuana. Now, at the time of the homicide, he had an 11-year-old son and a 6-year-old daughter with his estranged wife. Now, after 6 years of marriage, Cerna's wife filed for divorce in February of 2011, and in March of 2011, they agreed to share parental responsibilities, suggesting no concerns about Cerna being a danger to the children. Cerna worked for about 3 years as a maintenance man at Cap Ferrat, a Pelican Bay condominium, receiving generally positive performance reviews. And he also coached his son's youth football team and played drums in a death metal band. But several people interviewed by detectives said those interests didn't reflect any aggressiveness. I mean, could you imagine being like one of the parents after this, finding out that he coached one of your children? Scary thought.
Cerna's journal, however, points to disturbing, previously unknown tendencies that he harbored. A picture shows people being hung from a tree. He also wrote things like, "I kill, no regard for human life." In an undated writing, Cerna described elaborate fantasies of murder, often in vulgar terms. He repeatedly referenced words associated with dark thoughts: pain, fear, hate, devil, blood. One writing reads in part, "I'm waiting alone in the darkness, ran away from the light, I'm left haunted, searching for ways to escape. The only salvation I know is to murder."
Wow. Well, obviously, Christine Moritz's death had a big impact on Cerna, but was that enough to tip the seemingly ordinary guy over the edge? I mean, Moritz's murder could have induced some sort of underlying unseen mental illness. Well, Patricia Zapp, a Tampa-based forensic psychologist, told the Naples Daily News that major life changes, or stressors in clinical terms, are occasionally tipping points for those with previously undiagnosed mental illnesses. It's possible that all of us have a proclivity to become mentally ill, but when the right circumstances happen, those stressors can cause or push them over the edge and into a mental illness. That's what Zapp said when she was referring to Cerna's case.
But she was not familiar with the case. She was just asked for her opinion.
Got it.
So co-workers told investigators Cerna was acting bizarrely prior to Bishop's death. John Gagliardi, the man that Christine Moritz had gone to see in the hospital that day that she was murdered, he was actually the one that was in the hospital.
Not Cerna.
Said Cerna was acting particularly tired at work the day before Bishop's body was found. He said Cerna skipped lunch before leaving work early. Now, in general, Gagliardi told deputies Cerna had a formidable temper and sometimes threw, quote, tantrums while on their maintenance jobs together. He said Cerna would often throw things in anger but never showed any violent tendencies.
Well, keep in mind...
Here, I have a question, though.
What's that?
How can somebody throw things in anger but not show any violent tendencies? Because I feel like when you throw something in anger, that's a violent tendency.
It depends on the capacity. And let me preface. I'll go ahead and explain this. I've been working on a car before and a wrench slip and you bust your knuckle. You get mad, you throw the wrench. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm a violent person. It just means that I got angry at the wrench for slipping and busting my knuckles. That's just what happens. So I guess it depends on what capacity he's referring to, like throwing stuff, like if something, you know.
I guess maybe you're right.
If he's throwing a tantrum, that's a little different. But if he just throws a wrench or something, that's a whole other story. Now remember, this was a coworker. So John Gagliardi worked with Cerna, and we spoke earlier in yesterday's episode that Cerna had said that he was not the person that was there, even though that Jeffrey Moritz, which is Cerna's
nemesis.
Exactly.
Maybe.
Thought that he was. So that's who John Gagliardi is.
Okay. So Lionel Cerna, Christopher's father, said his son did not have a short fuse. It's been 10 years since this horrible murder, and we still have no answers as to why he did this, why he murdered Suzanne Bishop in such an awful, horrible way.
And sadly, in researching this, I don't think we're ever going to, but...
I don't think we're ever going to really get in his head and figure out why he did what he did.
No,
unfortunately.
But we'll get into it in a little bit. The web does get a little thicker. So at this point, now, Christopher Cerna pled no contest to second-degree murder in 2015, and this is 4 years after the murder. And he was sentenced to 50 years in prison. And the Collier County prosecutors told Wink News the plea deal is a win. Some people wouldn't think so, but it was. Because in a statement to Wink News, Assistant State Attorney Dave Scuderi said the goal was a life sentence, and this effectively accomplishes that. 50 years based on his age, yeah, that's pretty much a life sentence.
He was 38.
So yeah, you're pretty much a life sentence. Now, prosecutors said Bishop's family was aware and understood why the state offered Cerna the plea deal. So obviously, using those cases, and maybe you can clarify this, is that something they do, like the prosecutor would go to the family and say, hey, this is what we're looking at doing, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, that's common practice.
Okay, so obviously the prosecutors did approach the Bishop family and explain the situation, and they seem to be okay with it to the best of their abilities, I'm sure.
But it should be noted that Christopher Serna is currently appealing his conviction. He states that he didn't take his meds the morning he agreed to the plea deal and blames his lawyers for taking the plea against his wishes. So Serna's current attorney, Anna David, argued to the appeals court his client wanted to go to trial. The defendant's mental health issues attributed to his inability to take a plea in this case intelligently, and that his rights were violated for full, especially because he didn't take his medication, David said.
I'm kind of curious as to what medication it was, but I guess that's neither here nor there.
And that's a HIPAA now, violation. We'll never know.
I understand that, but that's what I said, neither here nor there. Now, here's a question. Do you think that Christine's murder triggered Christopher Serna's homicidal behavior and consequently the murder of Suzanne Bishop?
Well, I think, from what I know, that obviously Christopher Serna had some deep down issues, obviously some mental health issues. He had some really dark fantasies based on his journals. And I think that maybe Christine Morris's murder tipped him just over that edge. Traumatically, it had to be traumatic for him. This woman that he was seeing, they obviously had a good, solid friendship. They also had a little bit of a romantic. He described it as like a casual romantic, but they talked. They talked about their marriages. They talked about religion.
In turn, became friends.
They were obviously close,
yeah.
Whether it be romantic or not. And she's brutally murdered by her husband.
And
Serna has already said that he believes that it's his fault.
So he feels a little bit of guilt there.
So I think that maybe that situation is what tipped him over the edge and made his homicidal, murderous fantasies into a reality.
Yeah, well,
and Suzanne Bishop just happened to be, unfortunately, at the wrong place at the wrong time.
With the wrong guy.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious, and here's something I couldn't find, and maybe you found it, was, were they together prior to, were they together while he was seeing Christine?
Who, Suzanne?
Yeah.
I don't believe so. I don't believe they ever actually had, like, a serious relationship. From what I gather, they went on a couple dates.
And that's Christine?
No, Suzanne.
Okay.
He went on a couple dates with this woman. From what I've gathered, she was a lot more interested in him than he was her. So maybe after Christine's death, he maybe wanted some comfort and she was there. But then he ended up
not wanting comfort.
I don't know.
Tough.
And I
it's
don't
tough.
It's
That's
tough.
Why I just had to pose the question because sometimes I want to kind of know, you know, is this one event obviously leads to another, and that was kind of my question. So, well, I guess that's it, right?
Yep. Nope. Yep. Nope. Because there's more.
What kind of more are we talking about here?
Well, first, I would like to pose another question.
To me.
Do you believe that murder is hereditary, or that there is a murder gene that can be passed from one generation to the next?
I guess that's a tough question because I don't necessarily know. Like, I mean, you think of like the serial killers, and I'm not saying that obviously there's so many different types of serial killers in different municipalities, things like that. I mean, they're small, but the big ones, I don't picture like Ted Bundy having a gene that he's going to leave to a son or daughter that was going to have that happen. I can't think of any other big serial killers who had children that performed the same acts. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Do you know of any?
I feel like I do. I just can't think of it off the top of my head right now.
Because if so, that would be a very scary situation.
Well, according to The Mirror, a British newspaper, scientists now say they have the answer. A study was led by Professor Jari Tihonen, who analyzed the genes of 895 Finnish criminals.
So
like
Finland
from Finland. Yeah, not Finnish. finished from Finland.
They weren't done. They were actually from Finland.
So this study was published in the Journal of Molecular Psychiatry, and the findings concluded that violent criminals have a particular set of genes, but these genes were not carried by petty criminals. They found that the majority of violent criminals carried the gene known as MAOA and CDH13. Now, the report found, quote, "Our results from two independent cohorts of Finnish prisoners revealed that monoamine oxidase A, which is MAOA, low activity genotype contributing to low dopamine turnover rate, as well as the CDH13 gene, the coding for neural membrane adhesion protein, are associated with extremely violent behavior, at least 10 committed homicides, attempted homicides, or batteries. The report also states no substantial signal was observed for either MAOA or CDH13 among nonviolent offenders, indicating that findings were specific for violent offending and not largely attributed to substance abuse or antisocial personality disorder. The report concluded at least 5 to 10% of all severe violent crime in Finland is attributed to the aforementioned MAOA and CDH13 genotypes.
Which at this point is suggesting that it's possible.
The MAOA gene, also known as the warrior gene, has a complicated heritage. So the MAOA gene codes for the enzymes monoamine oxidase A, which plays a key role in the breakdown of neurotransmitters such as serotonin. Individuals with defects in the MAOA gene that are associated with low dopamine turnover rates have been shown to be more prone to aggressive behavior than their counterparts. A rare point mutation in the MAOA gene that resulted in a total loss of monoamine oxidase A was found to be associated with repeated generational incidents of violent criminal behavior among members in a Dutch family. According to Berkeley Scientific Journal, back in 2010, an Italian judge made legal history by decreasing the already reduced sentence of a male convict accused of murder after the convict was found to be a carrier of the genetic variants that were thought to be associated with predisposition for aggression. The convict's sentence was reduced prior to this intervention because he had schizophrenia and was actively psychotic at the time of the crime. However, at the appeals court, the defense was allowed to conduct a genetic susceptibility test, showing the convict carried variants of the MAOA, COMT, SCL6A4, and DRD4 genes that have all been associated with aggression modulation, which later led to modified sentencing from 9 to 8 years.
So they modified the sentence of people that they potentially believed harbored this gene. So,
like, it's just not their fault. They inherited it.
Can you just do a quick breakdown?
Basically, it's the MAOA gene is known as the warrior gene. And from what – and I am no scientist. And if any scientist or somebody is listening, please feel free to email or reach out to us and correct me if I'm wrong.
Or discuss it either way.
Or we can discuss it. But from what I'm gathering here is this certain gene or defect in this certain gene that has something to do with serotonin and dopamine. Now, when a person has depression and they take antidepressants, they take different types of antidepressants that either up their serotonin or up their dopamine to get rid of the depression or anxiety or whatever it is. Well, in this case, it looks like there may be some defect in this gene that lowers the dopamine. Dopamine is what makes you happy. Serotonin is what makes you happy. So they just naturally have this defect that lowers these chemicals in your brain that make you happy, and they obviously make them more prone to be aggressive and violent. That is my very layman
description of it.
I mean, honestly, it gets
technical, but you know, to go into your point, let's go ahead and let's just take a minute to talk about this tangled web that we're in at this point.
Okay, so here we are. We have this tangled web. We have Christine Moritz being murdered by Jeffrey Moritz, her husband.
Yep.
And then we have Christine's lover, Christopher Serna, brutally murdering Suzanne Bishop.
I mean, brutally murdering meaning dismembering.
Dismembering.
That takes it to a whole new level.
So why I'm talking about is the murder gene hereditary.
Exactly. So
because we have one more murder we're going to discuss.
That's associated to this family.
That is associated to this tangled web of murder.
Exactly. So let's take a look at it. Now, the headline in the Naples Daily News article published on January 14th of 2013 reads, "A former Golden Gate Estates man whose father awaits trial in the shooting death of his mother at North Naples Hospital was killed after a police standoff at his Georgia home where investigators found body parts of a missing man." Sound familiar? That's why I wanted to bring up, make sure it was dismembered, because the connection's there, but the connection's not there, and we'll discuss. So the police went to Chad Moritz's home to ask him about a friend. Now, if you all remember, Chad Moritz was shot at by his father because...
Chad Moritz is the son of Jeffrey and Christine Moritz.
Who was shot at when he went to the dentist, and the dentist that his father, Jeffrey Moritz, had...
We talked about that in part one.
Wouldn't pull his tooth. So this is Chad Moritz at this point now. So police go to Chad Moritz's home to ask him about a friend of his, Charlie Ray, who had gone missing... and quickly found themselves in a tense standoff when a relative answered the door and whispered, "He's got a rifle. He's going to kill y'all." After a nearly five-hour standoff that began when authorities said Moritz held his wife Kimberly Moritz hostage, Chad Moritz, who was 34 at the time, and he's the son of Jeffrey and Christine Moritz, well, he was gunned down by the Savannah, Georgia SWAT team at his Rincon, Georgia home. And it was at least the fourth time in 18 months deputies had gone to see Chad Moritz. And deputies jailed Moritz on July 23rd of 2011, not quite 3 weeks after his mother was killed, when his brother-in-law told police he had received a frantic phone call from his sister saying Moritz was chasing her with a machete. And Moritz's wife denied this whole story, and the deputies charged Chad Moritz with trespassing when they found him hiding by a shed in the neighbor's yard. In May of 2012, neighbors called the sheriff's office when they said Moritz stabbed a dog that had gotten loose after he'd been bitten several times. And in November that year, a friend told police Moritz asked for a ride, and when he refused, he pointed a gun at him and threatened to kill him and his family. And deputies also arrested Moritz on charges of making terroristic threats on December 22nd of 2012, and the jail records show he was released on a $3,500 bond on the same day. This was almost 2 weeks later. Neighbor Ross Maruco called police after seeing a TV news report that Charlie Ray was missing. And Maruco knew Ray because he had lived at Moritz's house for 2 or 3 months the previous summer. And the neighbor, Ray Maruco, had said that on January 2nd, he had seen Charlie Ray at the house.
So Charlie Ray is the missing man that police went to Chad Moritz's house to ask him about. Now, after Chad was shot and investigators were able to enter the home, they found the partial remains of Charlie Ray. Amid the filth and roaches and foul odors, police found the missing man's severed head and two hands hidden behind a kitchen cabinet inside a hole in the wall.
Huh?
Yes.
It was actually, so he tried to hide it?
His head and his hands were hidden behind a kitchen cabinet inside a hole in the wall. The rest of the body, dismembered by a power saw, was wrapped in bags and discovered in a storage locker a half an hour away in neighboring South Carolina.
So he'd already bagged this guy up and disappeared some of the body parts in a totally different state.
Right.
Wow.
"I don't believe there was a motive," said David Eisenpour, an investigator for the Effingham County Sheriff's Office. "It wasn't a drug deal gone bad or a love triangle. Chad was just crazy. Charlie Ray had been a friend of the Moritz, and his family had been searching for him since New Year's Eve. Now, an autopsy showed Ray was stabbed more than 40 times and had been dead more than a week before his remains were found. Now, Moritz's wife told investigators her husband and Ray had been drinking and talking, then started arguing. She said Chad grabbed a knife and started repeatedly stabbing Ray in their kitchen. Investigators suspect Ray's body was dismembered to make it easier to hide.
And keep in mind that this is the son of the same man who went into
the hospital, shot his wife in the head.
Who also, we found out later, had two knives on his person. So
true.
And again, that goes back to what Lauren just went on about with the hereditary.
Is it hereditary?
Exactly. It's a very legitimate question, especially in this case. It's
yes.
A very legitimate question. Okay, so Chad and Kimberly Moritz, they had moved from here in Southwest Florida where the violence devastated his family a year and a half prior with the murder of his mother. Now, as we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, Chad's father, Jeffrey, had gunned down his mother, Christine, in the hospital, and that was in 2011. Now, according to his neighbor, you could look at him and tell something was wrong, just that look he had. And this is Ray Romuka, and that's what he said. He looked like he was dazed all the time, which I can understand. I mean, if you're a neighbor to this guy, you pay attention because when somebody new moves to the neighborhood, you got to feel him out. I mean, we kind of know our neighbors, and I can tell you which one's crazy. Well, I won't tell you which one's crazy because I want you to worry about
then,
it.
Then I'm just going to be freaked out all the time.
You're going to constantly look at him thinking, this guy's crazy. Well, Ross Maruca also said that Moritz didn't work and let his grass grow knee-high before Maruca decided to cut himself. So not only is he's thinking that the neighbor's crazy, he thinks he's lazy. He's got a lot of bad vibes from the neighbor.
Well, and apparently their house was disgusting, roach-infested, hoarder-type, didn't mow their grass.
Not favorable as far as Ross Maruca, as far as he's in his eyes
right.
as a neighbor. Because he said that Moritz once showed up at his door and asked his wife for food and money. So the wife, this is Ross Maruca's wife, gave him $20 and he said Moritz would pay him back later, which he did.
He did pay him back, yeah.
Exactly. So he borrowed $20, said, I'll pay you back later, and he did come back and paid him back. But it doesn't bode well to go borrow money from your neighbor. It's just not I don't know.
So police initially talked to Moritz's wife, Kimberly, who said Ray wasn't there. Days later, they decided to return to the suburban neighborhood of Modest Brick Homes to talk to Moritz himself. Now, his brother-in-law, Kevin Lambert, met detectives at the door and whispered a warning. He said, Chad's in here. He's got a rifle. He's going to kill y'all. Detectives dragged Lambert out of the house and retreated. Moritz, armed with an assault rifle, refused to come out or to let his wife leave. A hostage negotiator and SWAT team were brought in.
So that was the relative that answered the door. This is his brother-in-law.
Yes,
so
this is Kevin Lambert. This is Kimberly Moritz's brother.
Exactly. So
now, if you go back, and what we talked about earlier when we said that her brother had called 911 saying that Chad was chasing Kimberly around with a machete.
Yes.
This was Kevin Lambert that made that phone call.
That's what I was trying to clarify. Was this the same one that was involved before?
Yes.
So he already knows that Chad is slightly unstable.
Right.
And obviously he's aware of what happened with Chad's parents.
Yes. So after more than 4 hours, Kimberly ran outside through the front door and collapsed in the yard. Then Moritz emerged with an AR-15 rifle as he was raising the gun when a sniper shot him. Though investigators say they believe Moritz alone killed Ray, his wife and brother-in-law were charged with helping conceal the death. Although an Atlanta social worker testified that Kimberly Moritz suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and battered person syndrome. She claims Moritz's husband, Chad Moritz, physically and mentally abused her, just like his father, Jeffrey,
correct,
physically and mentally abused his mother, Christine.
Well, and obviously, being Kimberly, you already know what happened to the parents. So now, not only is she probably living in this domestic violence situation, she's even more fearful.
Yeah.
Because of what happened to the parents. Man, can this happen to me? So now she's definitely getting like the double whammy, because not only is she fearful for what could happen to her, it's already been proven that in her family that this is the kind of thing that could potentially happen.
So an Effingham County jury convicted Kimberly Morris of concealing Charlie Ray's death and hindering an arrest. She was sentenced to 10 years in prison with an additional 5 years of probation.
I'm going to be honest. I have a slight problem with that conviction.
I do too, but...
I mean, she did conceal the murder, obviously assuming that she knew what was going on. She had to have known. She had to have known.
Well, she later admitted that she saw them arguing and she saw her husband
stabbing.
Stabbing.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know.
I mean, you're still supposed to...
If you see something, say something.
Yeah.
So you're right. Absolutely. We have to work on our own premise here, because...
Exactly.
If she saw it, she should have called the police. But I guess not at the time, because prior to police arriving, she could have potentially been... under the same, she could have basically...
Exactly.
Exactly. So that's a fine line there. I'm not gonna walk on it anymore, because I don't want to go any further with that. Now, Kevin Lambert pled guilty to hindering the apprehension of a criminal for his involvement in the death and dismemberment of Charlie Ray. Obviously, he's involved too, so he's going to have to face some sort of sentence. Maybe he didn't witness it, but he obviously knew something was wrong.
Right.
Well, Superior Court Judge F. Gates Peed sentenced Lambert to 5 years of probation and required him to stay out of the Ogeechee judicial circuit and stay away from Ray's family. So obviously, he had to stay away from the family of the victim. He had to stay out of the county, just get out of here, go away, disappear.
Right.
So he kind of got some leniency, which I can understand, because maybe he came in after the fact.
I don't think he was directly involved or even there at the time, but he knew about it.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think he was involved, and he knew that there might be a problem, because he even told the police when they arrived, hey, he's got a gun, he's going to kill you all. In other words, I know he can kill.
Yeah.
So, again, teetering again there, too. So
that's basically the end of this tangled web of murder, and now maybe you understand why we named this episode, this series, part one, part two, The Tangled Web of Murder.
Well, can I get into something here for a second?
Sure.
If you don't mind. Here's the issue that I
do mind. Shut your mouth.
Yeah, right. I'm not surprised. But no, seriously, here's the part that I don't understand. Now, and this is where it gets confusing for me in this case and the way it lays out, because you've got Jeffrey Moritz, who goes into the hospital, and he thinks that he is going there to see his wife and possibly his wife's lover. So he's very angry. He's going to go murder his wife. Obviously premeditated, because he had two firearms with him. He had two knives. I don't care what defense they use. It was premeditated at this point, because you can't fight the fact that it's premeditated. So he goes there and he shoots his wife and then attempts to kill himself. Then you have the victim. And remember, she's a victim. Yes, she was having an affair with Chris Cerna, but she is a victim of this crime. And she didn't deserve to die, by no means. Regardless, you're having an affair that doesn't warrant death in any way, shape, or form. So, unfortunately, she fell victim to Jeff Moritz. Now, her lover, which is Cerna, Christopher Cerna, he kills his girlfriend and chops her up. Well, Jeff and Christine's son, now he kills Charlie Ray, and he dismembers Charlie Ray. So he enacts the crime that his mother's lover did, but he didn't enact the crime that his father did. So, yeah, that's where I get confused with this. It's like, because we were talking about being hereditary and things like that.
It's a tangled web of murder.
Exactly. And that's kind of where I'm left with this. It's like, whoa, this is...
It's like, what the actual fuck?
Exactly.
I'm sorry. This is an explicit show. I can say the F word.
Yeah, so I mean...
But this is where it's really warranted, where you really have to ask yourself, what the actual fuck?
And it's like the victims in this case, regardless of what they did, no one deserved anything that happened to them. But man, it's like, where did crazy happen? You know, it's like it happened everywhere. I just got confused, because I got confused with the fact that I kept thinking that Cerna was the father of Chad because of what happened, but then I knew that he wasn't.
Mm-mm.
But the acts are the same between the lover and the son, but not the same between the father and the son. It gets to be real confusing. So if you want to go back and re-listen to this episode, go for it.
By all means, because
it's confusing, you know. And so with that being said, it's just they're not related by blood, but obviously that gene is inherent.
I would really like to hear what our listeners think about this story and some of the questions that we posed surrounding these three murders. So please, feel free to email us or reach out on social media with your thoughts. We're just as confused and baffled as you probably are right now. So,
you know,
let's start the discussion.
So when you see this post hit.
Let's see if we can figure this out.
When you see this post hit, make sure you hit Lauren up on social media. I'll follow, but Lauren will answer. And here's the thing. You've got to be – now, you're an investigator in this case. So, obviously, what we ask for you is, you know, the thing this is – I mean, basically, how do you feel about this, whatever that Lauren's asking the question on? Imagine what the detectives feel. Yeah. So, the detective that's working the case –
I would love to get one of those detectives on this show, but they won't talk to us about it.
Not really. Although it's possible at some point.
Maybe someday.
Maybe if we get engaged in some conversation online, maybe that gives us – that will warrant some – you know, maybe they want to clarify, be like, hey, your people, you guys keep talking about this on Facebook or whatever, and you need to stop. So anyway, imagine what the detectives are thinking when they go to the Jeffrey Moritz scene and then they find out about Christopher Cerna. Maybe one of the detectives shows up at that scene because, remember, it's all Collier County, and then they later find out about this. So the detective that's seen all this, they probably can't wrap their head around this. Even detectives who are familiar with this probably are a little lost. So please, let's get online. Let's discuss.
Let's discuss. And stay tuned. Next week, we are going to do a CrimeCon recap. We're going to give you a rundown of everything we did, all the people we met, how much fun we had. We're going to make you guys so jealous.
Exactly. You'll be so jealous, you're going to want to come to the CrimeCon next year. Trust me, you're going to want to come because it's going to be Vegas, baby.
And again, if you would like to support the show, please subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/ParadiseAfterDarkPodcast.
And like we talked about earlier, be sure to check out our website for links to all of our social media, our Patreon, the merch store, and much, much more.
And one last request. Please make sure to subscribe to the show on whatever platform you're listening and rate and review. This really helps us branch out and reach a wider audience.
Yes, if it's a 5-star review, leave it. If it's not, email us.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to put it in there. Anyway, everyone, thank you guys so much for listening
to Paradise After Dark.
Dark, 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 dark.